Hi, I'm Carmen LaBurge. Thanks for listening to the podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge.
Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting in what you say. Today is the day. Today is the day.
Good morning. Today is the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. Today is June the 21st, summer solstice. So prior to the show, my producer, Paul Perot, informs me that this is the beginning of astronomical summer.
There is a difference.
I'm going to tell people that. Exactly. Okay. June the 21st at 10:54 a.m. Central, astronomical summer actually begins. Meteorological summer, he tells me, started on June the 1st. And I asked him then, when did experiential summer begin? And I have to tell you that in places like Minnesota, I'm not sure that experiential summer has even yet begun.
I tell you, it is the best. But when it gets here, it's the best week of our lives. I tell you.
For those of us in the central part of the United States, experiential summer is certainly already upon us. So whether or not you are observing the beginning of meteorological summer or astronomical summer, or experiential summer, here is what I want to say about this day. Today's the day in the Northern Hemisphere when we have the most hours and minutes of daylight. That's it. It's not actually a longer day. You get the same number of hours in every day, but today you get more daylight if you live in the Northern Hemisphere. So if you are listening to us in Alaska, today is the day the sun literally never sets. That is a really fascinating experience. I've only been to Alaska once. It happened to have fallen over summer solstice, so I got this experience of 24 hours of daylight. It is pretty fascinating. Dawn was breaking here where I live at about 5 a.m. It's going to be daylight here until nearly 9 p.m. tonight. So I'm wondering, you know, what about where you live? And how many hours of daylight do you have today? And how might you work that into a conversation today? How might you work the gift of more light into a conversation today? It was into the void of darkness that God spoke. God pierced the darkness and something called light dawned. God's the one who dreamed it up. God spoke it into reality. Before God thought of it and created it, there was no such thing as light. Light is also one of the metaphors that John uses to describe Jesus. So with the advent of Christ, light pierced darkness again. John says of Jesus, in him was life. And the life was the light of all people. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness could not comprehend it. He goes on to say of Jesus that he was the true light coming into the world, enlightening everyone. He was in the world was made through him, and yet the world did not know him. Why not? Well, John tells us because people love darkness. They preferred darkness to light. They preferred to live in darkness, where they imagined their sins would not be found out. Now later, Jesus says of himself, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. So on this day, when there's literally more light available than on any other day of the year in the Northern Hemisphere, people around you are still walking in darkness. As a follower of Jesus, you have the light of life. That's what Jesus says. He says of himself, I am the light of the world, and whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but have the light of life. So the people around you today are walking in darkness. You, as a follower of Jesus, have the light of life. That makes you a light bearer, a shining star, as Paul calls it, a beacon, a lamppost, a reflector of the light of Christ into the darkness in which your neighbors and your coworkers continue to grope in fear. So today, on this summer solstice, when some will literally worship the sun, as you and I follow the true light, the Son of the living God, let us be faithful witnesses in the spirit of John the Baptist, of whom the scripture says, there came a man sent from God. He came as a witness to testify about the light so that others might believe. He was not the light, but he came to testify about the light. That's our calling on this day, to testify about the one who is the light, to bear witness to the true light who has come and indeed is coming again, even Jesus Christ. So lest we forget the reality of darkness, we're going to turn our attention next to the plight of widows around the world. Here's a statistic for you. If all the widows in all the world were gathered together in one place, they would make the fourth largest country on earth. So up next, Danny Yohannan, Vice President of Gospels for Asia, will be here to talk about the need of widows for hope and how you and I can be agents of grace in the life of a widow this week. That's next on Mornings with Carmen. Joining me now, Danny Yohannan, Vice President of Gospels for Asia. Danny, welcome to Mornings with Carmen.
Good morning. It's good to be here.
Thank you. It's so nice to have you. So this coming Sunday is the International Widows Day. And so we want to talk today about widows. We want to talk about just how many widows there are in the world, the experience that they are having, and how we as gospel people might alleviate their suffering and actually align ourselves with their concerns. So let's just start with the statistics. Tell us about widows around the world.
You know, usually when we think of a topic like widows, it either hits people's hearts or it kind of just runs by right by them real quick. And the reason is a lot of these things, whether we're talking about clean water or widows or children, just because we don't see it right in front of us, often we kind of just imagine that it doesn't exist or it's not even a real problem. There's over 250 million widows that, you know, as you've mentioned, if you were to gather them together, it would be one of the largest countries in the world. The reality of that many millions of widows that are in need and helpless and basically just challenges even the opportunity of how do we even reach out to this many. And so, you know, the fear is that saying 250 million is such a large number, people can't even wrap their, you know, their hands around it, their minds around it. It's huge numbers of people that are neglected, that are abandoned, and there's different reasons for it, but the numbers are so massive to imagine that this many millions of people are basically sidelined with often no hope. And that's probably the most heartbreaking thing, is not only are they abandoned in a sense in terms of poverty, but they also don't know Christ loved them, don't know that Christ brings hope to their life. And that is one of the most heartbreaking things. And that's what, you know, Gospel for Asia is all about, not just, you know, reaching out to people in some physical need, but also to meet them spiritually. And so we do both. And so that's our very heart. And especially widows is one of the things that we really take serious to be able to challenge and take you know, face on.
So if you want to read the report that Danny and I are discussing today, you can find it at gfa.org. That's Gospels for Asia, gfa.org. They've got a special report posted there. Widows worldwide face tragedy, discrimination. Some find hope to overcome the challenges of widowhood. The numbers are staggering. The individual stories are particularly heartbreaking. Danny, I think that it's difficult for people here in the United States and Canada listening right now. It's hard for them to imagine the kind of situations that these women find themselves in. It's hard for us to imagine that on the day your husband might die, before his body is even cold, his family might come and seize all of your belongings, including your house. Like that is difficult for us to imagine. But talk with us. Tell us one of these stories, because you actually highlight a number of stories in this report. Tell us a story, because it's one thing to say there's 250 million women suffering in this way as widows around the globe. It's another thing to, you know, come all the way down, bring that focus all the way down to the individual story of one person so that we can better understand what's going on. So when we come back from the break, our breaker is going to be really quick, you guys. When we come back from the break, Danny Yohannan from Gospels for Asia is going to share with us the particular story of one widow. And then we're going to talk about how we as Christians can respond. That's up next here on Mornings with Carmen.
We believe in God the Father. We believe in Jesus Christ. We believe in the Holy Spirit. And he's giving us new life.
We're talking this morning about the plight of widows around the world. You and I certainly know as believers in Jesus Christ that it is the mandate of those who believe, those who practice true religion, to care for orphans and widows in their distress. And so we're trying to bring widows into focus this morning. This coming Sunday is International Widows Day. There are an estimated 250 million widows in the world. If you add to them the concerns of their orphaned children, which on average is three per widow, you're talking here about a billion people, or one-seventh of the world's population. So we're talking here about a massive number of people who are affected in this way by the death of their husband. And so Danny Yohannan is here from Gospels for Asia. And they are bringing this not only into focus today, but this is a ministry in which they are engaged around the world every day. Danny, talk with us. Tell us the story of one widow. What is someone experiencing right now in terms of being a widow in the world today?
You know, there's a widow named Golka. And, you know, when her husband passed away, as in some of these really developing countries, it may not be the way that we easily understand it here, but oftentimes the widow is blamed for the husband's death, whether it was an accident on his part or something happened, very, very superstitious. And so it is because of her that the husband has passed away. Therefore, in a sense, she has become a curse, and people want to have nothing to do with her. And that's why you have the stigma of being a widow, and sometimes you see the family abandoning her and all kinds of things. And so, you know, Golka was one of those women that, you know, had a normal life in a village, and all of a sudden when her husband passed away, people considered her to be a curse. And so when she walked down the road, people would mock her, and they would talk to her as if she was some kind of cursed individual and stay away from her and, you know, make fun of her, preventing her sometimes from even gathering water from the public well, which means that she would have to walk far away. Already women in many of these places have to walk many miles to collect water from public water sources because they may come from a low status in society, and they're not allowed to take water from the public well. And so now on top of that, being a widow, now she has to have the mockery of everyone else and being considered a curse, and also the rejection in society. Oftentimes, many of these widows would not wear any color after their husbands die. They just wear very plain, either gray or white, signifying that their life is miserable and misery. And so this is something that is just very heartbreaking, because when we think of, when we think of our grandmothers, or we think of, people that we love, it's a different thing. We have love and respect and hope and care for them. But in many of these places, it's the opposite. You become the source of being the curse that is a bad thing for everyone. In another place, this widow, she was not taken care of by her family. Her family would refuse to buy her a mosquito net. That sounds a little strange for us, but I remember traveling to the mission field one time and, sleeping, and then in the morning waking up and having about 50 or 60 mosquito bites all over me. It was pretty bad. But in places where there's malaria, it's even worse, because you catch that disease, and then all of a sudden you end up sick, and sometimes very, very severely sick. One of my friends had gotten malaria about 15 times, and the doctor said if you get it one more time, it's going to possibly permanently affect you. And so you have many of these widows living in places where there is high levels of malaria and dengue fever and other issues. And for them to refuse a simple mosquito net that could at least bring a little bit of relief while sleeping, protect her from malaria and some of these other diseases, they refused. And so, you know, that was when Gospel for Asia's field partners were able to come in and help with a mosquito net, as we, you know, help many other families, over 120,000 families a year, with different Christmas gifts and items like that, to be able to bring relief and hope and healing to people's lives. But, you know, you have this, you know, story repeated over and over and over again, where these widows are abandoned, or these widows are not taken care of, or their family rejects them. Some of this goes back to a very, you know, ancient practice of the wife is the cause of the husband's death, and therefore the family wants to take back the property, so the property and the farm stays within the original family, is not separated or divvied out. And so part of it is a deep-rooted thing that goes back for hundreds or even a thousand years. And unfortunately, it plays out even today in people's lives, where these widows are abandoned, not taken care of, and they are not understood to have human dignity. And so this is the challenge before us, that whatever we can do, we should be doing. Like you mentioned earlier, what James says, you know, the true religion is to take care of the widows and orphans, because those are the ones that are most vulnerable. Those are the ones that are the greatest need. That's why Christ would say, bring the children to me, let them come to me, because they are the vulnerable ones. They are the ones that are in need of God's care the most.
So, Danny, bear with me for a minute, because I'm gonna speak to the hearts of the people who are listening right now, who may not have ever really examined this subject biblically, and so let me just put a note on this, because when Danny talks about widows we may know in our own culture, my mom was a widow at the age of 45, and so this is something that happens culturally here in the United States. I don't even quite know how to describe to you what it feels like to be a child whose parents are very well respected, and we had the, you know, tremendous support of community. But you go from being an intact family of four to being suddenly a family, in our case, of all women, and where, you know, nobody invited Ruth Ann to anything anymore, because, you know, it was no longer Larry and Ruth Ann. So it's no longer that you're inviting a couple. And so she didn't get invited to stuff that obviously the two of them would have always had been invited to. So there is a cultural ostracization in our culture as well. And I think people need to know that and need to recognize that there are widows in your own community to whom you can turn today. They're not weird. Their husbands didn't die because they were married to these women. Widowhood still retains a stigma today, even in our culture, even if the seizure of physical property is, in many cases, not a part of the experience of widows here in the United States. In some cases, it is, particularly if your husband is a business owner and you don't know how to deal with his colleagues. So let me lift up a couple of verses of scripture as we go to the break here at the bottom of the hour. And again, Danny Yohannan from Gospels for Asia, thank you so much for illuminating this issue for us. You guys can read the report at gfa.org, and you can support the efforts of Gospel for Asia there at that website. Let's remember James 1:27. Religion that is pure and undefiled before God the Father is this: to visit orphans and widows in their affliction and keep oneself unstained from the world. Psalm 68:5. Father of the fatherless, protector of widows, this is God in his holy habitation. Deuteronomy 27:19, cursed be anyone who perverts the justice that's due to the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow. And all the people shall say, amen. We'll be right back. All right, just to be clear, we're not in any way suggesting that you drive under the influence of anything that your doctors or any prescription medicine says you should not drive under the influence of. So even though we enjoy the humor being offered to us, we're certainly recognizing the power of the things that we put in our bodies to influence not only our behavior but everybody around us, and how tragic those outcomes can be. So just let us be open-eyed and clear about what we're talking about, even when we're enjoying humorous moments together. Okay, next up, Justin Gibney is going to be back with us from the AND campaign. There were reparation hearings on Juneteenth in Congress this week. I think it's important for us to have that conversation. It's going to be a conversation taking place in the culture. It is a conversation taking place in parts of the culture. It's one that I think for a lot of people provokes an immediate reaction of defense. And so, I want to be the person who makes us comfortable having uncomfortable conversations in order that we can be gospel people in every conversation. And so I'm wading into the very uncomfortable conversation related to reparations today. That's up next with Justin Gibney from the AND campaign. So we're coming up on the end of June. That is the end of our fiscal year here at Faith Radio. If you have been enjoying this programming and other programming over the course of the hours of each and every day, we encourage you to actually join the giving team. Be a part of our support system here. Become a partner by giving generously at whatever, at whatever level that is for you. So you can call 877-933-2484. You can give securely online at myfaithradio.com. And if you're listening via the Faith Radio app, there's a donate button right there in front of you. So join the team today. Be a part of what we are doing at this listener-supported ministry. We'll be right back.
Welcome to Postmodern Culture. This is Jim Garlow. Postmodern means a radical reappraisal of modern assumptions about culture, identity, history, or language. Millennials embrace this culture and reject all that went before. Truth and morality have become purely subjective to them. According to the 2016 Barna study, 74% of millennials believe there's no absolute truth or morality, but even claiming there is no absolute truth is self-contradictory. And who says something like stealing is wrong? Now, a millennial might respond by saying, as long as no harm is done to others, it's okay. But how do you define harm? If a rich man drops his wallet, you can rationalize that any cash is a drop in the bucket he'll never miss. No surprise here. Teachers in schools have lately been instructed to tell kids to do whatever they think is right. What could possibly go wrong there? Get well-versed at wellversed.world.
Joining me again today is Justin Gibney from the AND campaign, and we are going to wade into deep water. And so, Justin, welcome back. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, Carmen. Thanks for having me.
As soon as I say the word reparations, there are people who become defensive. And so I recognize that even as you and I begin to have this conversation, we are having a conversation that's being held, that's being had among some groups of people in some settings, completely avoided by many people in many settings, and being had in other places and spaces in a way that's going to be completely different than the way you and I are going to have the conversation today. So I recognize that. I'm not afraid to wade into this water with you. But I also recognize that there are those listening who are immediately defensive when I even say we're going to talk about reparations. So thanks for your willingness to talk about this subject. Danny Glover, 2 days ago, told a congressional hearing that reparations are a moral, democratic, and economic imperative. He's been a longtime advocate for reparations, and he urged the passage of House Resolution 40, which would create a commission to study reparations. I'm just going to open the floor and let you talk about this subject matter area. Help us understand what we're talking about and how we're talking about it right now, at least at the congressional level.
Yeah, so the case is this. Given the history of America with Black Americans from slavery, Jim Crow, redlining, and all those things, the idea is because there's been such a harm done, right? If you look at slavery, it's very clear that a large part of the American economy was based on free labor. At one point, almost 50% of it was free labor. And so you look at that and you say, well, you still have institutions that are benefiting from those things. And we need to look at how people can be compensated from what happened. Now, the tough part about this conversation is when you say reparations, it's such a broad range of what somebody could mean, right? It could be from somebody thinking you should cut a check to someone saying, well, let's just give extra consideration when it comes to funding for school and things of that nature. So it's a broad range of possibilities of what somebody could mean by reparations. And I think that's some of the reason why it's kind of hard to talk about it, because people don't know exactly what you mean by that. And so I think Danny Glover gets it right to say, based on the history of America, it does not hurt us to put together a committee to study what this could look like. I mean, you have examples, whether it be the Japanese internment, things like that, where consideration has been made. And so there is precedent for it, but it's certainly something worth looking into based on the history of it. The problem is, what does somebody mean when they say that? And there's such a broad range that I think we need to kind of focus in on a couple different solutions.
Okay, so let's talk about those solutions as you see them, because, you know, I'll just admit to you, Justin, I raised this as a conversation point yesterday with somebody who most of the time does not get defensive when I raise subjects that are provocative. And this individual, I mean, he folded his arms, he leaned back in his chair. This is an interesting touch point, even for people who are Christians, and who, when we talk about race and when we talk about the need for conversation, and when we talk about the need for reconciliation, and we talk about the gospel imperative, and we talk about, you know, the one blood, when we talk about all of those things, they're all on board, you know, their arms are not crossed, they're leaning in. When you introduce the term reparations into the conversation, it is immediate pushback. And so I want us to introduce some ideas today that will draw those people back into the conversation.
Well, I think you just have to start with the history. And so if you're going to get upset about the conversation, are we denying that slavery happened? Are we denying that Jim Crow happened? Are we denying that redlining happened? I mean, and we can go on and on. And so before we get offended, because and we talk about this all the time, Carmen, it's really a matter of self-examination rather than self-defense. And so anytime you go into this conversation with self-defense, you don't have to agree with me. I mean, I'd love to hear the arguments on both sides, but to be upset about a conversation, especially with that kind of history, just doesn't make sense to me. So I kind of think we have to start with the history and then go into the precedent that has been set in other situations, which might not even have been as long or as intense, where you had, you know, people kind of being recompensed for things that happened. I think it becomes more of a sensible conversation. And then again, getting to what is meant by this, right? What do we see the solutions as? And to me, it starts with a commission. It starts with really doing the research and finding out what are some viable options in comparison to what happened.
Okay, so give us some of the ideas that you view as possible, potential, legitimate ways forward in this conversation.
Yeah, and I hesitate a little bit on that because I do think the study is important. So I try not to get out ahead of the conversation to say it should be this, this, and that, because I do think actually looking into it, seeing how it equates to what's going on today is very important. But I can give you just some ideas. For one, you know, looking at education, when it comes to education and making sure that people, black people, have funding, more funding for education, whether it's higher education or otherwise. That's one way to go about it. It's not just necessarily about writing a check. And so we may have to be more creative in what that looks like, but the study is important. So I hesitate to have people jump ahead of really doing the work to see what the actual damage was, and then getting to what would be a viable option and kind of repairing that.
Okay, so in my conversation with this individual yesterday, I'll just invite you to help me respond better than I did, maybe. But now I don't know. It's possible I responded okay, and I'm just need to till the soil again the next time I see this individual. What I said to him was, you know, because he starts down the laundry list of, you know, how unrealistic it is, you know, how many people we're talking about, and you know, we're already in debt, and welfare hasn't worked, and I mean, so I like get the immediate. It's interesting, the list of reasons we come up with for why we can't do something. And I said, well, okay, so let's just let's just talk about how expensive it was, you know, for America to offer 40 acres and a mule. And he's like, well, that's in the day we're trying to get people to, you know, expand to a different part of the country. And I said, yeah, but it was something that wasn't even available. Like, if you were black, you couldn't have 40 acres and a mule. Like, that wasn't an option for you. So, you know, are there ways in which today we could be creative, we could have conversations? And he says, well, what do you really want? What are you looking for? And I said, here's my challenge. I don't want people who currently have access to the things that they have access to for that to be taken away. But I want people who don't have access to those things simply because generationally they are black. And therefore, the things that have been available to me and my family have actually not been available to them. Like, I want to figure out how to fix that. And and so I think education, I mean, you know, Justin, my answers are as simple as if you're white and you've historically sent your kid to summer camp and your kid has, you know, outgrown that and you're not doing that anymore, this is your summer to send a black kid to summer camp. Like, it's simply about figuring out ways to do things that we have always made available in the white community that have simply not been accessible in many black families.
Yeah, that's good. And I think one of the wrong ways to approach it is this going to work? Right? Because that's the wrong question to ask. If something is owed to somebody, it's really not your judgment to say, well, I'll give it to you if it's going to help you and if it's going to work. That's not necessarily the consideration you should make. I think you first have to say, is something owed there? And once something's owed, as all members of this social contract, we are all somewhat culpable for what's going on. And so, yeah, you got to approach it in a way, first and foremost, with the history and to figure out what is owed, what's the value of that today, and what can we do that's viable to help people out. And I think, you know, you make a very good point with the summer camps, tutoring, all that kind of stuff can be very helpful in the black community where a lot of times you just don't have those resources.
Okay, so when Justin Gibney and I come back, we are going to wrap up this portion of our conversation and talk about some other things that are in front of us as people in the United States of America at the intersection of race and faith and politics. So Justin Gibney from the AND campaign and I will continue here in just a moment. Continuing my conversation with Justin Gibney from the AND campaign. Justin, my family and I went to see the Emmanuel movie on Wednesday night, and lots of other folks went on Monday night on the fourth anniversary of the shooting at the Mother Emmanuel Church in Charleston, South Carolina. We have talked here on air with Jennifer Barry Hawes about her book, Amazing Grace, on the topic. You know me, Justin, so you know that when I walked out of that theater, I wanted to talk to African-Americans with whom I sat in that movie. But I found myself almost paralyzed in terms of like what to say. It is humbling to sit in a mixed race theater and watch that film. And there's one photograph in particular, and all you see at the very top of the shot are, you know, black feet, clearly victims of lynching, and a white crowd is actually in view. I mean, that's who you see is this white crowd, but above their heads, right at eye level, are these black feet. And of all of the images in the film, although different members of my family in our conversation in the subsequent days, different images of the film have really stood out to them and are the places and the points at which, you know, God obviously pierced their heart. But that image for me is the one that, you know, I can't get out of my mind. How is it that white Americans ever did such things? And then as soon as, you know, you say that, you see the footage of a black man in a green shirt being shot in the back 5 times by a white police officer. It's not as if this is ancient history. And I think that if there's anything that is brought to light by this film, it's that we are at a different place in American history, but we are not at a place in American history where this is a resolved issue.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, this is a sad history. It's a painful history, and it's one that we have to confront with everything that we have, because there is a certain view of African Americans that allows this to happen. And so I think one of the things you mentioned was sitting down with people, watching this with them, and building relationship. You may not have the right words at that moment, but to be there, for people to see that you care, to see that it affected you, that's a good place to start. And so I think when we get into those situations, we want to have the right answers. We want to say the right things. Don't want to stay away from saying the wrong thing. And sometimes it's good to just be there and let people know that you care and that you're there to be supportive. But we really have to work on just the images that people see of African Americans, because you do have this dehumanization. You have this almost feeling that the pain isn't the same. The assumption, the stereotypes, the assumption that someone's going to be more violent than someone else is, which just aren't true, which lead us into these situations where people are getting shot. And, it's a broad issue that we have to deal with an understanding that we all have issues, that we all are broken. And really, this is just kind of the manifestation of our brokenness. And we have to be deliberate about turning the tables and making sure that we don't see other people as anything less than we are, with families and people who care about them. And for some reason, people don't necessarily see African Americans in that way. But I think it's a lot of it has to do with the images that we've seen and what we teach people and what we allow people to get away with. So something else you can do is when you're in your own circles and you hear something that's racially insensitive, correct it and correct it in a loving way. And that's I think those are two really good places to start.
So what does that look like? Imagine that I am in an environment where I recognize that someone says something that is racially insensitive or just, flat out theologically wrong. I might be inclined to just say, okay, that's, I don't know where you're coming from on that topic, but that's, first of all, not true, and not helpful. But what are some words, or would you tell a story? What would you do? And are you, and let me, maybe it's a better question. As a black man, are you in a position to say something, or as a white woman, am I in a better position to say something?
I think anytime something like that comes up, I'm certainly going to say something. But I think because of your connection within your own community, it is at times more effective for you to say something. And we talked about being anti-racist and that not just being something for black people, but for white people as well. And you got it. I think to say that's not helpful, and to say, you can use, Emmanuel as an example. You can use the young man who got shot in the back as an example. People are suffering. And the more that we continue with certain narratives and even stuff that we joke about, it becomes real. And those become real seeds that are planted in our psyche about and how we look at other people. Right. It impacts our lens in which we see other people. And so we can't let people get away with saying things that are insensitive, because they may seem just playful and like it's a joke. But especially when there's kids around or others, it plants seeds that really impact how you treat other people.
So following the movie on Wednesday night, I think you will find this humorous. We all walk out of the theater and, it's a very somber. I mean, it has clearly affected people, and you don't quite know how to respond. You are, in an audience with people who you don't know them personally. And so we all get to the front door of the theater, and it is pouring down rain. I mean, with such a volume that it's not like any of us are walking out into that parking lot. So it's as if God kind of like traps us all together, right, in this very narrow hallway that leads to like the one covered area next to the parking lot. And so one individual from each group is bravely running to the car, right? And so now we're like at a valet stand, essentially. So one car is coming up at a time and a family's jumping in. One car is pulling up and a family's jumping in. So we're standing, my family's standing next to this African-American family, and the dads have gone to get the cars. And I'm desiring to say something, and I'm like, I don't know what to say other than to say, I just want to acknowledge that we were in that theater together. Like, I don't really know what else to say, but I saw what you saw, and I just want to acknowledge it. And she kind of like nodded knowingly, and but there was no, you know, what else are you going to say? And a car pulls up, and it happened to be my car, Justin, but it must have looked exactly like their car, because she and her kids run out to it and jump in. And I'm standing there. I couldn't stop her. Like, right? And so she's now in the car with actually my summer intern, whose name is Brooks, who was driving. And she looks over at him. And, I mean, she bursts out laughing. She jumps back out of the car. She runs back over. And I'm like, he would have taken you home. Like, he would have driven you home. He's a good guy. Anyway, so now we're all laughing. And there's this, like, gift of shared laughter and shared humanity and just a moment of hey, we are kind of all in this together at this point. And so anyway, I just thought you might appreciate that God is providing opportunities not only for us to be together in pain, but for us to be together in moments of joy. And I love having these conversations with you, even though they are difficult to have. And so thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me, Carmen.
That's Justin Gibney from the AND Campaign. We'll be right back. Okay, all kinds of instant harassment that I sent to my intern to get the car in the pouring down rain. Okay, my husband was also there, and he went to get his truck. So there you go. We were in two vehicles. We have a lot of people. All right, that's it for our first hour. But up next, we are going to have the Up and Adam Hour. Both of my guests in the next hour are named Adam. And so it's going to be the Up and... Thanks for listening to this podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge from Faith Radio. If you haven't, you can subscribe to automatically receive the podcast through iTunes or the Google Play Music app. That way, you never miss an episode. It's also available anytime at myfaithradio.com.